This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So it really gives me a great pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Katie Kelly. Her presentation is going to be on treatment for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, which is very important, as I mentioned, that the incidence of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is clearly on the rise, whether you have PSC or cirrhosis from Hep B, Hep C. And Dr. Kelly is from the Division of GI Oncology at UCSF. She's the recipient of the 2014 Cancer Clinical Investigator Team Leadership Award from the National Cancer Institute. Her clinical research is focused on clinical trials for novel targeted agents and combination therapies in HCC, as well as cancer's biliary tract. And her translational research effort, she's taking a lead role in trying to study and identify markers of tumor biology and also circulating tumor cells. She has been a wonderful collaborator, and I can speak for transplant surgeons, hepatobiliary surgeons, and hepatologists. Katie has been our go-to person whenever we need oncology help for our practice. So, it's a wonderful opportunity for me to introduce her to give a presentation on intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. Thank you very much, Katie.
Thank you very much, Francis, for the introduction, and to all the members of the organizing committee for inviting me to speak today. My presentation is, as you can see, treatment of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, a disease on the rise. And I will try to stay on time since I know this is cutting into the break. So the objectives in talking about this disease at a transplant conference or a liver hepatology-focused conference is that, as Francis introduced, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is a cancer of significantly rising incidence recently, and it overlaps quite a bit with our patient population for hepatocellular carcinoma. So I wanted to review this rising incidence as well as the risk factors, diagnosis, and staging as quickly as possible just to set the stage and without hopefully getting into too much of the oncology esoterica. And then really focus on the current roles of treatment for both liver-directed and systemic therapies in unresectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and provide an overview of what's ahead and the changing landscape of treatment in this cancer. So I'd like to preface the talk by reviewing, which always bears review, the complex anatomy of the biliary tree and the cancers that arise from it. And so when we talk about advanced biliary cancers or biliary cancers of any stage, we're including a grab bag of quite a few different anatomic locations and lumping them together as a family for pragmatic reasons. So cancers of the biliary tract include intrahepatic biliary ductal epithelial cancers, including intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, shown here in these little representative white dots. Those are also sometimes called peripheral cholangiocarcinomas. And when a cholangiocarcinoma arises from the biliary epithelium right at the junction of the right and left hepatic ducts and at the start of the common bile duct, that's called a perihilar cholangiocarcinoma, also known as the eponym Klatskin cholangiocarcinoma. And then the extrahepatic, or outside the liver, common bile duct cancers include mid and distal extrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. For good measure, we often lump together gallbladder carcinomas when doing clinical research in biliary tract cancers and for epidemiology studies, which further complicates our understanding of the cancers, and sometimes even periampullary. So looking at the numbers from the SEER database for liver and intrahepatic bile duct cancers, which again are pragmatically lumped for many epidemiologic studies because they have similar ICD-9 coding and often are difficult to flesh out from coding databases, we see that there's been a significant increase, about threefold increase in the incidence and deaths from liver and intrahepatic bile duct cancers between 1975 and 2012. And this is a significant rise for unclear reasons, probably in part due to immigration patterns, but also due to rising risk factors for these cancers. It's difficult to flesh out exactly which proportion of those curves is due to HCC and which is due to intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, but those groups that have looked at intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma numbers in the United States as well as in many other countries, they also see a similar rise in just the IHCC component, with now the incidence reaching close to 1 per 100,000 people in the Western world. So again, why is this rise? We think that in part it's ascertainment, where you have potentially a shift of cancers of unknown primary now being called intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma instead of just being an adenocarcinoma of unknown primary found in the liver. So there is some ascertainment shift. But there's also a real increase in the risk factors underlying these cancers. This long list of risk factors is in your packet, but highlights some of the overlapping risk factors for both intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma as well as HCC in the box here, including hepatic disorders such as hepatitis B and C virus, cirrhosis, which itself increases the risk for IHCC or any cholangiocarcinoma by 22-fold, according to this meta-analysis data. And even conditions that increase your risk for fatty liver, such as diabetes and obesity. These overlapping risk factors require us to be very careful when we look at a patient with cirrhosis or other liver disease and a new liver mass to make sure that we are considering the possibility that the tumor we're seeing on a scan is actually an HCC versus the possibility that it's truly an occult cholangiocarcinoma. And this is on my mind and something I wanted to highlight today because these three pictures are examples of patients that I've seen just in the past month alone as second opinion referrals who came in with a diagnosis of HCC. This one here with an enhancing mass that did not wash out, had a history of both hepatitis B and C cirrhosis, and had been treated previously with an RFA without biopsy for a diagnosis of HCC. And when he came in, you can't see it quite so well here, but there's a little lung met there, and I ended up getting a biopsy, and this turned out to be a cholangiocarcinoma. Similarly, this patient here had a heterogeneous mass with extensive portal vein tumor thrombus and hep C cirrhosis, and was temporarily on a transplant list, I think, elsewhere, and came in when he was found to have vascular invasion and was started on sorafenib, and we ended up getting a biopsy to see if he would be eligible potentially for a clinical trial. And his biopsy likewise came back with adenocarcinoma consistent with cholangiocarcinoma, not HCC. And then this third case is yet another patient just this month who had a non-enhancing tumor with extensive vascular invasion but really didn't meet ASLD criteria for radiographic diagnosis since there was no enhancement and was very infiltrative in the setting of NAFLD. And another cholangio example. So again, the message in this is to be very careful that the patients who have the risk factors for HCC and a liver mass do need to meet radiographic criteria for HCC diagnosis without biopsy. So I highlighted the current AJC staging in IHCC, not to go through the nuances of it, but rather to highlight, again, that intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas are also known to have vascular invasion, just like HCC, and it's part of their staging. And that any lymph node involvement is considered metastatic disease owing to the propensity of spread in these cancers. So how do we treat localized IHCC or intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma? The mainstay of therapy and the only curative option is resection. And again, I would like to highlight with this point that if it's a resectable lesion, we would certainly advocate, as would our surgical colleagues, for a surgical biopsy, meaning a resection, rather than proceeding with a percutaneous biopsy first, just to avoid the risk of seeding the peritoneum for somebody who may be theoretically curative. In the majority of patients who are unresectable but localized, these patients have greater than 60% chance of extrahepatic or a systemic disease spread within the first year after diagnosis, even if the disease is confined to the liver. So really the Category 1 evidence in the NCCN guidelines are to be treated with systemic chemotherapy. But chemotherapy is not a cure, and chemotherapy certainly confers toxicity and is at risk for resistance over time. And so we will often look at the possibility of sequencing chemotherapy with liver-directed therapy, such as ablative approaches, stereotactic or proton beam radiotherapy, chemoembolization or radioembolization as a strategy to mix modalities and control the local disease while addressing the possibility for micrometastatic disease at the same time. As you might imagine, there's really no prospective evidence to guide us on how to do this at this time point, and our decision-making is really guided purely on individual patient characteristics, comorbidities, their prior treatments, where is this tumor located anatomically, how did they respond to chemotherapy, and what's our institutional expertise with the modalities at hand. The NCI is conducting a large cooperative group or a National Clinical Trial Network group study called NRG-GI001 to address the question of four unresectable intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas that are confined to the liver. Does chemotherapy alone with a combination of GemCis do better, that, or should we add in chemotherapy followed by radiation to try to really consolidate the liver control after doing systemic chemotherapy? And that's a randomized trial ongoing right now. Another point I wanted to just touch upon briefly is a commonly asked question is, in the small subset of patients, probably less than 20%, unfortunately, who are eligible for a potentially curative surgery, is there a role for adjuvant chemotherapy in those patients afterwards to try to lower their relatively high recurrence risk? And again, the refrain, unfortunately, for this talk is that we don't have great data for that either. But there is now meta-analysis data published in 2012 from the Princess Margaret Group in Canada, where they looked at over 6,700 patients' data who had undergone potentially curative surgery for biliary tract cancers. And they did show in the high-risk populations, node-positive and margin-positive patients, that there was a significantly higher recurrence-free survival in patients who received either chemotherapy or chemoradiation or both after surgery. And so we do recommend, or our practice is to have patients who've had a surgery for cholangiocarcinoma come to see an oncologist to at least talk over the data we have, the data we don't have, the decision-making about adjuvant therapy, because there is such a high recurrence risk and there is now some, at least, meta-analysis data to guide the decision. For advanced intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, which is, again, the majority of our patients at some time point during their diagnosis, the median survival is less than a year for patients who have advanced disease as defined by node-positive or vascular invasion or metastatic spread. Before 2010, there was no Category 1 or randomized prospective data to really guide oncologists on what chemo to use, and so we tended to use things that we use in pancreas cancer or things that we use in colon cancer, and that led us to use generally gemcitabine or 5-FU-based regimens, as you know. In 2010, the British group, led by Juan Valle et al., conducted the ABC-02 randomized phase 3 trial showing that the combination of gemcitabine plus low-dose cisplatin was superior to gemcitabine alone and was quite tolerable with acceptable toxicity. And I'll show you the survival benefit that led to that becoming the new standard of care for advanced disease. And in that study, they included intrahepatic, extrahepatic, and gallbladder cancers alike. And so it became the standard treatment for any advanced biliary cancer, again, taking the lumping approach of considering them as a basket. But despite the success of that study, at least in this sort of difficult field, as of today, we still don't have any proven data to show us what to use next, because most patients do eventually progress. So here's the survival curves from the ABC-02 trial showing about a 3.5-month survival benefit from the combination of GemCis over GemZAR alone. And again, this was conducted through the United Kingdom National Cancer Research Network, which is how they were able to enroll so quickly and so effectively all of their patients onto this priority trial. And again, the median overall survival with the combination is about 11.7 months, so again, establishing about a year as the benchmark for advanced disease first-line survival. And I'll skip that. There is no established second-line therapy. This is a key area of need, particularly in medical oncology, because, again, most patients do progress after within 6 to 8 months on the first-line regimen of GemCis. A big study in France looking at around 600 patients across community centers showed that whenever patients were given 5-FU-based regimens or other catch-all standard second-line therapy, again, there's no prospective data to tell us what to use, the median second-line progression-free survival was pretty dismal, only about 3 months before they progressed and fell off treatment, and they survived about 6 months. And they showed similar data about 2.7 months, so really the chemo was not working very well in a similar subset conducted at MD Anderson. We recently looked at our outcomes at UCSF and pooled data with Memorial Sloan Kettering and Vanderbilt in a retrospective multicenter analysis of second-line chemotherapy outcomes between 2011 and 2014 in a post-ABC-02 era, meaning after the British data showed us what to use first-line. And again, disappointingly, we see that our best guess at what to do next gives us about 2.2 months time on treatment before patients progress, which again means one scan and they're off. So nothing is working. probably owing to us all three being referral centers with fit patients and relatively good candidates for studies, and we also showed a pretty longer than expected median overall survival for our cohort, only of 11 months, so longer than the sort of community survival experience in the French group. And interestingly, a theme I'm about to come to more, we saw differences between our intrahepatic, extrahepatic, and gallbladder survival data, with intrahepatic survival being about 13 months compared to extrahepatic of 6.8 months. Now, I will couch that in the caveat that this is a small group, only about 198 patients total across our three centers. But the big question as we move forward is, how do we deal with the anatomic complexity and what we believe is a growing understanding of the biologic complexity of these cancers when we try to do research to find treatment advances? So to find better first-line therapies, to find better second-line or any second-line therapy that works, and to better understand why is this cancer growing so quickly, how can we target it? So this is a sort of a busy slide, not intended to be read in its minutiae, but the point that I wanted to make with this is that not only is this a very anatomically complex cancer, but the cancer we're learning from our colleagues in the lab, which who are a huge influential part of the research going on in this field, that the anatomic location is really a surrogate for the underlying biology, and that there are differences in the genomics as well as the cells of origin based upon where a cancer pops up. And those differences may significantly impact response to treatment as well as prognosis. And so this is a set of data that was presented at ASCO last year by the Foundation Medicine team. For those of you who aren't in oncology, Foundation Medicine is a giant sequencing company recently bought by Roche and Genentech, which commercialized a next-generation sequencing panel of about 400 oncology genes, meaning genes that are known to play a role in cancer, and many of which have drugs that target these aberrations in tumors. And so this panel was conducted, tumor genotyping was performed on a giant number of patients in the Foundation Medicine database, largely from standard of care tests ordered by people like me who are trying to figure out what to do with their patients. And they ended up having 412 cases of intrahepatic, 57 of extrahepatic, and 85 of gallbladder, for whom they obtained sequencing data for about, as I said, 400 genes in their panel. And lo and behold, we see that there are some of the key driver oncogenes that we know about in cancer, such as ERBB2, and that's the HER2 gene that we know of in breast cancer that is targeted by Herceptin. There's a significant difference with an increased representation of HER2 amplification in gallbladder compared to intrahepatic or extrahepatic. And likewise, we see FGFR2 fusions showing up in a significantly higher number of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas and almost zero extrahepatic or gallbladders, and IDH 1 and 2, also in intrahepatic and zero in extrahepatic and gallbladder. And so there's probably many other genes like this. These are just circled because these are the significant ones that were pulled out from this panel and circled because they have drugs that target them effectively based on preclinical and data from other cancer types. So if you drill down specifically into a data set from intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, this is a comprehensive whole exome sequencing, RNA-seq gene expression profiling data set from Joseph Yove's group at Mount Sinai, where they looked at 107 cases of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas and characterized them by their gene expression as either proliferative subclass, which they had validated in a previous data set, versus inflammatory, and then looked at their actual mutations. We see, again, several recurring themes, which are interesting to me as an oncologist looking for treatments. Specifically, they found using whole exome, 45% of their intrahepatics in this 107-case series had FGFR2 fusions, and almost 20% had IDH1 or 2 mutations. And again, those are genes that can be targeted. So what are the implications of this? There are recurring high-frequency somatic mutations in some cholangiocarcinomas. Some of these mutations may be prognostic, and some of these represent driver oncogenes amenable to targeted therapy. And this sort of is a circling back to Nora's comment earlier about really targeting hepatitis C. Well, we hopefully are getting somewhere closer to doing that with cancer. This slide just highlights that it is possible in oncology to do this. We're following upon the successes of, for example, the ALK inhibitors in ALK-rearranged non-small cell lung cancer, which has been a dramatic change in prognosis and outcome in that subset of lung cancers. Similarly, in basal cell carcinoma, the hedgehog inhibitor family, and in melanoma, the BRAF inhibitor. So this is not a new thing, but it's a significant change for cholangiocarcinoma. So this chart, again, is not intended to be read in its detail, but to highlight that there now are multiple clinical trials open for targeted therapies in cholangiocarcinoma, including FGFR2 fusions and IDH1 and 2 inhibitors. And then I included here the immunotherapy target PD-1, program DEATH-1. So FGFR2 fusion inhibitors are present, depending on the assay you use, in up to 45% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas. Novartis has a drug that's a very potent inhibitor, BGJ398, and we have that phase 2 trial open at UCSF. The initial cohort data will be presented at GI ASCO in a couple months. IDH1 and 2 inhibitors are also targeting a somatic driver mutation in about 20% of intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, and the data for their first sets of cholangiocarcinoma cohorts will be presented this weekend at the triple meeting in, I believe, Boston. So to end in my last minute or two, as a GI oncologist, we are always looking for wins or for the high points in what is a status quo, generally a bleak day. And I think in oncology, you know, you've probably heard about the advent of immunotherapy, particularly in melanoma and lung cancer, with two recent PD-1 inhibitors, program DEATH-1 inhibitors recently approved by the FDA for lung cancer and melanoma. And those drugs are called Keytruda and Opdivo. And I wanted to share, as the last slide, some results of these drugs in cholangiocarcinoma. Just briefly how they work, the PD-L1 and PD-L2 ligand are proteins expressed on a lot of tumor cells. So in cholangiocarcinoma, about 40% of tumor cells express these ligands, PD-L1 or PD-L2. And this ligand sends an inhibitory signal to passerby lymphocytes and turns them off, and basically is a cloaking device that renders a cancer cell hidden to your own immune system. These two antibodies, the Opdivo or Keytruda, are PD-1 inhibitors that block that inhibitory signal and allow your passerby T lymphocytes or T cells to actually see the tumor cells for all that they are, and to see the little pieces of tumor antigen stuck on their surface and recognize those cancers for the first time because that inhibitory signal has been blocked. And so, this has been quite dramatic in terms of efficacy in many other tumor types and is changing how we look at solid tumors. And it's very exciting to see that these results are being borne out in biliary tract cancers as well. So Merck, with the Keytruda drug, conducted a giant basket phase 1 trial, probably the biggest phase 1 trial that was ever done. They had 20 different tumor types, and fortunately, they included a biliary tract cohort. They screened 87 patients, found that 41% of them had this tumor marker PD-L1, which was required for eligibility. They ended up treating 24 patients on study. 83% were cholangio, 17% were gallbladder, again, the lumping strategy. And they showed, you know, when you look at these numbers, it's not super exciting. Partial responses in 17%, stable disease 17%, you know, sounds kind of like chemo. But what's different about immunotherapy is that it's not a two-month response where you get a little bit of shrinkage and then the next scan the cancer grows again. These are teaching your own immune system to actually recognize, you know, the teach yourself to fish kind of mentality of teaching your immune system to do the job for the drug. And the responses that they saw in those responders have been extremely long-lived, lasting over a year in 3 of the 4 cases. And I highlighted here somebody who is my patient. We enrolled 3 of the patients on this study at UCSF on one of our clinical as a member of this clinical trial. And this is my patient, who was a intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma patient. I think Dr. Corvera did her resection. Nakakura did her resection, believe it or not. And she recurred almost immediately after surgery with bone mets, dermal mets, intracardiac metastasis. We re-biopsied because I hadn't seen a muscle met before, but it was cholangiocarcinoma each time. And she progressed very quickly right through GemCis after just 3 months on treatment, was looking very dismal for her. She went on to this clinical trial, and within 6 weeks, her dermal mets went away. And this is her scan of the liver recurrences, which showed after this scan was between 6 months apart, but significant regression in her hepatic recurrence. And now she's been on treatment for over a year and a half and has really zero toxicity and has yet to show any sign of progression. So one example out of many negatives, but it's a sign of hopefully progress to come by looking more closely at the actual mechanisms at hand. So in summary, Standard first-line therapy for advanced intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is a combination of gemcitabine plus cisplatin. There is no standard second-line therapy. Adjuvant chemotherapy or chemoradiation should be considered, or at least referral to oncology if node-positive, positive margins, or high-risk features. And we have clinical trials now ongoing for key driver somatic mutations in these cancers that are of high frequency, like IDH1, IDH2, FGFR2, and now immunotherapy approaches with PD-L1 and PD-1 inhibitors, which I think are the most exciting thing that I've seen so far. And I will conclude by saying this is a very complex disease. Anatomic classification is inadequate, and we need a new approach to make a difference. So thank you again for having me, and to all of my colleagues in IR, surgery, hepatology, without whom this is would be an impossible job.
Thanks very much, Katie. It was a wonderful presentation. So any questions? Oh, yes, Charlie.
Patients with perihilar masses, a CT-guided or MRI-guided biopsy, as I understand, is contraindicated because of seeding, tumor seeding, and would not be considered as a transplant candidate if you did something like that. Is that
That's correct. If it's a mass that's potentially within the transplant criteria for a perihilar, has to be approximately less than 3 centimeters without any evidence of nodal spread, then I would recommend referring to a transplant center to evaluate before doing a percutaneous biopsy.
So, yes, question.
Yeah, it's a little off the subject, but I follow a number of patients with sclerosing cholangitis from inflammatory bowel disease. And I wonder, should I be doing any screening? And if so, who, when, and how is my first question. My second question is I'm also using a lot of immunosuppressive agents on these people for both their intestinal disease and extraintestinal manifestations. Does that offer any increased risk for cholangiocarcinoma?
I might let Francis answer the screening question.
Yeah, you know, for a patient with PSC, you know, we don't have good evidence-based data to recommend screening, but there is a paper, kind of a position paper from the Mayo Clinic group. You know, they suggest it's basically a pragmatic viewpoint that you do annual imaging, CT or MRI, and also CA19-9. So not a whole lot of, you know, data supporting that, but that's what they are doing. You know, once a year, CT or MRI plus MRCP, and CA19-9.
Do the immunosuppressants play any role in enhanced?
Probably. So they're also at risk for gallbladder cancer as well. So that's why there's, you know, some of these patients are at risk for HCC and gallbladder cancer and hyalocholangiocarcinoma. So you're trying to have, you know, one study that can look at all these possibilities. Dr. Roberts.
So, Katie, on our explants, we sometimes find a 1.5 centimeter cholangiocarcinoma, or mixed cholangio, and we know that the outcome of those patients is going to be poor, despite having very small disease. What about sort of neoadjuvant therapy in that, you know, before they develop recurrent disease?
I think if a patient's recovered well from transplant and otherwise would be a candidate for chemo, I would probably treat them like a resection patient at this point and say, talk very carefully about the absence of data. But if they have a cholangio on explant, I would think about adjuvant chemo just like a resection case.
And do you think we should be looking for the PD-L1?
So the question of looking for PD-L1. So this is such a rapidly moving drug development era right now for the immunotherapies that there's not a commercial PD-L1 test yet. There's one that's being rapidly taken to market. For lung cancer and melanoma, they don't require PD-L1 expression to be treated with those drugs. The trials have, and it's not quite sure yet whether you have to even express that to benefit from the drug, meaning that they see some cancers benefit from PD-L1 inhibitors, even if your cancer doesn't have it measurable on the surface, which is great. We'd rather have not require that. So the long answer was that. The short answer is right now there's nothing to test with. But in the future, we'll certainly be seeing a lot more of this category of drugs and combinations in clinical trials and hopefully labeled eventually.
Oh, Just one quick comment and question for Katie. So the take-home message here is that, we should look at intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma separate from hilar cholangiocarcinoma. Hilar cholangiocarcinoma, some transplant centers are doing transplant on these patients, but intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, these are not candidates for transplant. So distinguishing between intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and HCC is really the key, because the outcome for transplant for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma is so poor. And there's some data suggesting that even the radiographic diagnosis is not 100%, reliable. You generally see, progressive enhancement into the delayed phases, but we are not always that perfect. Is that correct?
I think one of the other things that a lot of researchers are learning more about right now, and it's quite fascinating, is that there's a huge continuum between a cholangiocyte and a hepatocyte in development, and that probably HCC and intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma isn't a black and white difference, and that there's some continuum between the mixed phenotype and what's a cholangiocarcinoma and what's an HCC depends on the cell of origin and also its milieu in terms of the signaling. And so it's probably some plasticity at hand, too.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Oh, one more question.
Is there any data that the patients with so-called HCC, we couldn't downstage, were actually cholangiocarcinomas in the liver transplant literature?
In the downstaging literature?
What's the question?
I think the question is whether some of the patients who go on to have transplant after having had neoadjuvant TACE or downstaging protocols ended up being cholangios on explant. So one dilemma is that after a downstaging protocol, many of the tumors are rather difficult to interpret pathologically if they're very necrotic. But I think as John was commenting, that there are still surprise cholangiocarcinomas on explant periodically, and beyond that, I'll defer to Francis if he has numbers.
So we actually put a series together, not necessarily downstaging, and we found about, a dozen of these, previously thought to be HCC turned out to have either mixed or just intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. Some of them are like over 90% necrotic, and yet they still recur. So we made a mistake in diagnosis before transplant, before we really know the radiographic characteristics of these tumors. And even with really, high percentage necrosis, we still see recurrence. So there may be some evidence that very small, tiny cholangios, like less than 2 centimeters, may do okay. But right now, transplant is out of the question.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.